Welcome. Inside Appalachia, I'm Jessica Lilly. Today we have stories about an unsettling reality. Many people here in Appalachia, young and old, rich and poor, are falling victim to heroin addiction. True, heroin addiction is spreading in communities across the country. But here in Appalachia, people in remote rural areas have an even more difficult time finding access to treatment options.
My mom is also an addict, and my father, and they're also heroin users. And my sister is a heroin addict also, and she's also in prison.
And finding help in rural regions can be tough, so some folks are expecting a new treatment facility in southern West Virginia will be a game changer.
Every location that I've witnessed one of these programs go into a tough part of the neighborhood has gotten better.
You'll find these stories and more this week, Inside Appalachia. Welcome. Inside Appalachia, I'm Jessica Lilly. Today we're talking about the heroin epidemic that's sweeping through areas in Appalachia. While other drugs may claim more lives per capita, heroin overdose deaths are trending upward at an alarming rate. The available reports and data indicate that overdose deaths involving heroin are increasing rapidly, while overdose deaths involving prescription painkillers are leveling off or declining in many parts of the country. The Centers for Disease Control report that nationally heroin overdose deaths claimed more than 8,250 lives in 2013, an increase of almost 40% since 2012. But heroin isn't new. The opium poppy is a source of beauty in gardens and fields all over the country and the world. But it's also a source of pain relief and, when abused, death. In today's episode, several stories are from a special report called The Needle and the Damage Done, West Virginia's Heroin Epidemic. Our stories today are about how heroin came to be so heavily abused in West Virginia and in surrounding areas throughout our region. Glennis Board has our first story.
Like, the high was just extraordinary to me.
This is Ashley. She's 24, a mother of four, third-generation West Virginian, and currently she's going through a highly structured drug court rehabilitation program. But heroin was her whole world not long ago.
It just takes over you, like the feeling. When you use it, you're happy. You have no worries. Like, you can just be free. Like, you have no responsibilities. You don't have to deal with yourself. You don't have to deal with any of your responsibilities. That's all you think about, that's all you care about, and that's all you're out to get.
Ashley found the world of heroin early.
Right, I was 18 when I started using heroin. I had used other drugs previous to that, since I was 14. And I just wanted to try something new. I seen everybody else, you know, using it, and it looked fun. So then I decided to use it, and then when I started using it, I couldn't stop.
Ashley started experimenting with substances 11 years ago. She remembers her mom.
She was on crack, and I mean, that was hard, and I guess just seeing her use, she made it look fun, so I was interested, like I wanted to try it, and that's when it all began.
Well, I was a county prosecutor going back to 1997. That's when I began paying attention to these types of issues.
William Ehlenfeld is the U.S. District Attorney for the Northern District of West Virginia.
In the 90s and probably the 80s before that, at least what I'm told, it was powder cocaine and crack cocaine that we really saw a whole lot of in northern West Virginia.
Ehlenfeld says the shift to heroin is a recent development that really began to take hold in West Virginia in 2011. He says in the early 2000s, crack gave way to prescription pain pills. In 2010, prescription opioids accounted for 44%, almost half, of all U.S. overdose deaths. But law enforcement, legislators across the country, communities, and pharmaceutical companies joined forces to make pills harder to get and harder to abuse.
And then things started to change. We started to see the shift from pills to heroin, and we saw that through what was available on the street, what was being sold.
Ehlenfeld's counterpart in the Southern District, Booth Goodwin, explains prescription narcotics like oxycodone and hydrocodone are simply synthetic opioids designed to mimic the effects of the chemicals found in poppy plants. He says in Appalachia, over the past 15 years, we've developed an intense addiction to prescribed synthetic opioids.
We have a very bad addiction problem, not only here in the southern part of West Virginia, but nationwide. People think that they can take a pill and relieve almost any ailment, and it's just not that simple. And it takes work. And I'll tell you, this addiction to opiates is as bad as it gets.
But believe it or not, Goodwin says this shift to heroin may not be an entirely bad development.
There is a silver lining to it, if you could call it that. And that is, our young people won't just start off by shooting up heroin, whereas they will raid the medicine cabinet, take drugs from friends and families that they believe are safe because they come from a pharmacy or prescribed by a doctor.
That's how many people, young and old, rich and poor alike, started falling into the world of drug abuse, according to law enforcement officials. It's what happened to Ashley, too. Elenfeld says savvy drug lords responded to the crackdown on pills by shifting clientele to unregulated opioids.
We don't give them as much credit as they deserve as far as their business acumen. The people at the top are like Fortune 500 CEOs. They operate their business just like somebody would a major company here in the United States, and they identify areas of their industry where profit can be made. And when they see that pills, the ability to get pills has dried up and it's tougher to get them, they know that heroin is something that can easily replace that.
Ashley watched that shift happen on the street.
Did you see a lot of people shift over from pills to heroin?
Definitely. Yeah. A lot of people. And then, when you try to go back to the pills, it's just not the same. It's not as intense.
The difficulty you see now is in this shift to heroin is the likelihood of overdose growing exponentially.
U.S. Attorney Booth Goodwin explains that prescription narcotics are precisely measured by drug manufacturers who ship it to pharmacists to be prescribed in exact dosages. Anyone who reads the label knows exactly how much of a narcotic is going into their body. Heroin is not the same.
It's an illegal drug. With heroin, it can be 20% potency or 80% potency. And you'll never know. You're used to 20% potency heroin and take the same amount if you get a batch of 80% or if it's laced with fentanyl and you overdose and very likely die.
Lots of people are learning about what can go wrong the hard way.
It happened at my sister's house, and it was at night, and my sister called me and told me that her friend wasn't breathing. So I went down there, and when I went into the bathroom, she was laying over on the sink. Her airway was getting cut off by the sink. That's what we thought. And then we moved her, and when we did, like, she was still purple and wasn't breathing. And then finally she just, like, gasped for air, and she was back. And she had no memory of it whatsoever, and she wouldn't leave with the ambulance, so.
Things turned out okay for Ashley's friend that night. But many law enforcement and medical officials, families, and friends in West Virginia know that the coin doesn't always land heads up. And many say this is just the beginning of an epidemic that's bound to continue to grow in West Virginia. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Glynis Board in Morgantown.
We'll hear more about Ashley's struggle with addiction and the resources she found to help her get clean later at the end of our show. But her experience watching a friend overdose is unfortunately becoming more and more common. Dr. Derek Harmon is a young doctor, but he has seen his share of overdoses, not all of them from heroin. During this interview, Dr. Harmon uses the words heroin and opioids interchangeably. So what does it mean to overdose from heroin? What really happens to the body? West Virginia Public Broadcasting's Beth Voorhees met with Dr. Derek Harmon to get an answer to that question.
Heroin is a respiratory depressant, and basically you have shallow breathing and not many breaths at all, and you do not have enough oxygen to feed the body. And usually opioid overdoses and heroin overdoses included, people succumb to respiratory distress and then arrest and then death. So that's why it's so important and crucial to get to a patient that has had an opioid overdose, especially heroin, as quickly as you can, because they will stop breathing on you.
So you're an ER doctor. A patient is presented to you. Do you know if this person has overdosed on heroin, or at some point is it a guessing game as to what's wrong with this patient?
Anytime that someone comes into the emergency room, there's a whole slew of things that you go through. Initially, you're just worried about, is their heart going and are they breathing? And then you start to figure out things from there. You look for track marks. You talk to the paramedics. You talk to family. If you have some outside information that can lead to getting a better diagnosis. But everything from sepsis, which is overwhelming infection, someone could have a stroke that could present very similarly. Low glucose can present in a very same fashion. But it is a guessing game at the beginning, and often we have to use medications that will help us decide whether this is an actual opioid overdose, and you know that medication naloxone is key in that oftentimes.
Have you ever had to use naloxone?
Oh, absolutely. Heroin overdoses are becoming more common, and I've seen a handful of those, but I see opioid overdoses almost on a nightly basis to some degree. It may not be a comatose patient, but it may just be someone that's in a deep sleep and they're not waking up as well. They may be respirating fairly well, but naloxone, or better known as Narcan, is an injectable opioid antagonist. And what this means is that it will go into the body and displaces the opioid from the receptors in the central and peripheral nervous system, meaning that if the opioid is bound to a pain receptor, it will knock off that narcotic or that opioid and bind to that receptor, causing a reversal. It causes a reversal of the effects of the opioids. So almost immediately after giving Narcan, within a couple of minutes, you should see respirations to come back to normal, or at least, hopefully, to a rate that will sustain, you know, the patient. And it also will increase the patient's alertness. Again, respiratory distress and arrest is the most important thing. We give Narcan to improve that.
But Dr. Harmon explains it's not as simple as giving an overdosed patient one shot of naloxone.
And it depends on what opioids you are on, and it also depends on how much of the opioid the person has taken. But that initial dose of Narcan may not be enough. And also, it has a half-life, meaning that it only lasts for about an hour, maybe an hour and a half. And an initial dose of Narcan at home, for example, or in the field, is often not enough to overcome the complete dosage of heroin or opioids. So, you know, these patients, if given Narcan in the field at home, still need to come to the emergency room, because those opioids can again reattach to those receptors after Narcan has worn off.
State law now allows family members or friends to ask a doctor for a prescription for naloxone. Dr. Harmon says if someone came to his office worried about a family member addicted to heroin and asked for it, he would definitely write out that prescription. Okay, let's go back to the emergency room and think about our heroin overdose patient. This patient is breathing okay, seems to have come through the overdose all right, and is going to be discharged. What do you say to that patient? As the attending physician, what do you say before you let that patient walk out the door?
You were lucky. It's almost a game with the patient to say, look, you were lucky this time, and you're not going to be lucky again one day.
Dr. Derek Harmon is a family doctor and emergency room physician in Logan County, West Virginia. For more information about his practice and to hear an extended version of this interview, go to our website, wvpublic.org.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.
I'm Jessica Lilly. You're Inside Appalachia. In Pennsylvania, it's estimated that opiates like heroin killed at least 1,300 people last year. Heroin overdoses are also on the rise in other states in our region. But figuring out the size and scope of the problem is harder than one might think. For this next story, we're going to Pennsylvania, which, like many states, does not require reporting of specific details on drug overdoses. And whatever other information is available is at least 2 years old. Reporter Ben Allen from WITF in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, reports.
So it's Anthony Perez, and it has all his personal information.
Stacy Eminger is showing me the death certificate for her son Anthony, who was addicted to heroin. But that's not what's listed.
Immediate cause of death is multiple drug toxicity, accidental. So basically an accidental overdose.
Eminger, who lives in Mount Joy, a small quiet town in Pennsylvania's Lancaster County, says heroin killed Anthony. But the state's database doesn't have that level of detail.
It's critical. It's absolutely critical.
Dr. Kurt Nolte is the executive vice president for the National Association of Medical Examiners. He helped write a report that recommends listing out every drug found in a person's system.
The interventions for whether it's heroin or other illicit substances are different than, for example, if they are prescription drugs. And if you can't tell the difference because everybody's classified as multi-drug toxicity, you have no idea what's really killing people.
Not only does Pennsylvania's database only broadly note drug overdoses, but the most recent statistics date to 2012. And the Keystone State is far from unique on this. Many others lack a complete, up-to-date, and accurate database. Why does all this matter? In western Pennsylvania, heroin mixed with the pain drug fentanyl killed 22 people in a matter of weeks last year. Gary Tennis, acting secretary for Pennsylvania's Department of Drug and Alcohol Programs, says with a real-time database, paramedics might be better prepared to stop an overdose.
You might require more than one administration of naloxone. The first one might not do it. It's really useful for our emergency medical services to have that information that fentanyl's there.
Beyond stocking the antidote naloxone, law enforcement also knows what to target in undercover stings. And Tennis himself can use the statistics when pushing for state funding for specific treatment programs. Tennis estimates that the CDC numbers for Pennsylvania miss hundreds of opiate deaths.
They're still high. I mean, they're still incredibly high and tragically high, but I think probably more than that died.
Since Stacy Eminger lost her son Anthony, she's joined grief groups online and says parents all over the country talk about how it's a crisis in their area.
It's just amazing, suddenly, how heroin has just ballooned out of control. If you don't know how many people are dying from it, how do you know how to combat it?
In Pennsylvania, coroners can now send the state a standard form detailing all the drugs in someone's system. But the extra steps aren't required, and there's no public database set up yet. Until it launches, Pennsylvania, like so many other states, will have to rely on a patchwork of statistics to figure out exactly how deep the heroin crisis cuts. For NPR News, I'm Ben Allen.
So, overdose rates can be difficult to track, and most databases don't have complete information from the last 2 years. Still, there is information available, and we've posted a map on our website to show some of the data related to heroin overdoses in West Virginia, and where heroin has claimed the lives of more than 600 West Virginians since 2001. I'm Jessica Lilly. You're Inside Appalachia. Looking for a rewind button? Don't worry. Inside Appalachia is available as a podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, and wvpublic.org. You can subscribe and listen on your own time. You're listening to Inside Appalachia. We're going to jump back to our earlier conversation about drug overdose deaths, which are on the rise in parts of our region. In this part of our show, we're going to look at solutions and ways that people in Appalachia are working to solve the issue. Our friends over at WUNC in North Carolina reported last year that overdoses from illegal drugs in Wilkes County was once the face of the state's prescription pill problem. Folks are crediting a community education program and naloxone for dramatically reducing the overdose rate. So, in Wilkes County, people came together to try something new. They called it Project Lazarus, which uses a community-based treatment approach as a way to combat high rates of drug overdoses. Here's Fred Brazen, founder of Project Lazarus, talking about the success they had in dealing with the drug overdose issue.
As we looked at the issues and who needed to be involved and the folks that unfortunately were dying from overdose or emergency department visits or hospitalizations, you know, not everybody's dying, thankfully, but there's still issues out there. We realized it was all population groups, all ages. There's no ethnicity to this. There's no race. There's no income. It affects everybody. Then we realized we've got to address it through our village, our community. Because we have to change the individual's thoughts and behaviors regarding prescription medications, that's going to take influence, you know, in every aspect of their lives. So if somebody's a senior citizen and they're going to the senior center, they're hearing a message. If somebody is being arrested and there's crime and there's addiction, law enforcement can become engaged and get that person into help. So we worked with hospital, emergency department, health department, youth groups, you know, faith community, just bringing everybody up to speed on the problem, but answering three questions, I should say. Why am I needed? What needs to be done? And then what do I need to do?
That was Fred Brazen, founder of Project Lazarus, which has been working in rural North Carolina to help deal with high rates of drug overdoses, mostly from prescription pain pills. Thanks to WUNC for that audio clip. On our website, we've posted a link to the rest of that interview, which is part of an episode of the show, The State of Things. Brazen says that one of the ways Project Lazarus has been able to reduce the community's overdose rate is by helping to allow more people in the community to have access to a drug called naloxone, a non-narcotic that can save the lives of those who overdose on heroin or prescription painkillers. Now to Kentucky, where, according to WUKY News in Lexington, this legislative session, Kentucky became one of the first states to let pharmacists dispense naloxone without a prescription. Naloxone is a medicine that reverses the effects of narcotics. The Kentucky Board of Pharmacy has approved an emergency regulation for naloxone. The law gives pharmacists the option to dispense the drug without a doctor's prescription. In West Virginia, a law went into effect just this past week that allows family members of addicts to get naloxone with the prescription as an emergency precaution in case a person overdoses. The law is called the Opioid Antagonist Act. A version of that bill was introduced by Republican leadership in both the House and Senate the very first day of this legislative session, making it one of the top priorities for lawmakers. But as it worked its way through the legislative process, lawmakers approved a version of the bill backed by Democratic Governor Earl Ray Tomlin. Ashton Mara explains the bill itself and why it was a priority for both parties.
The 2015 legislative session was an interesting one, to say the least. After more than 80 years of power, Democrats were voted out of their seats at the head of both the House and Senate, passing the gavel to the newly minted Republican majority. The new House Speaker and Senate President introduced 15 bills the first day of the session, calling them their top priorities. Those 15 included some major reforms, repealing the state's alternative and renewable energy portfolio, requiring the nonpartisan election of judges, creating public charter schools. Ninth on the list, the Opioid Antagonist Act.
Addiction to drugs is a huge challenge for the future of our state.
Tim Armstead is Speaker of the House.
If we're going to really put our house in order and move our state forward, we have to address it.
And the Opioid Antagonist Act is just one way lawmakers believe they can address that problem. The bill expands access to a medication called naloxone. Naloxone comes in two forms, a shot, like an EpiPen, or a nasal spray, and through this bill can be obtained with a prescription from a healthcare provider. When a person is experiencing an overdose, when their airways begin to close and their heart begins to fail, naloxone coats the pain receptors in the nervous system, blocking the absorption of opioids. Within minutes, the person's respiratory system opens, they regain consciousness, and with additional medical care, can make a full recovery.
It saves lives.
Mitch Carmichael is the Senate Majority Leader and a staunch supporter of the bill.
The leadership team thought this saves lives. Other states have done this and implemented it. It's not like we're some radical agenda here, and it was the right thing to do.
But as the bill progressed through the state house, not everyone felt the same. EMTs have had access to naloxone for years. The new law expands its availability to include police officers and firefighters, but also the family and friends of those suffering from addiction, even addicts themselves. That sparked some concern for lawmakers. Speaker Armstead, who supports stricter penalties for drug dealers and says drug addicts should still face some kind of incarceration, heard those concerns.
I think there are some concerns about it and some legitimate concerns about it, whether it could be viewed as in some ways condoning drug addiction, which it certainly doesn't, and I don't believe it does. But I think that was some of the concerns that people expressed.
Still, he says he believes the bill was a step in the right direction.
So many families have been affected by this, and we have so many people whose children, who they never expected to ever get involved in drugs and take drugs, have gotten addicted. And these are good people who just have made a mistake. They've done the wrong thing.
They deserve a second chance, Armstead says, and that's what the opioid antagonist bill is designed to do. Governor Tomlin knew lawmakers would have concerns over the bill, though. After all, it had been introduced and failed in previous legislative sessions. Joseph Garcia, Tomlin's director of legislative affairs, says that's why the governor wanted additional measures written into this year's bill.
What we do in this bill is we rely on the licensed healthcare practitioner to, in good faith, prescribe this medication. And so that individual would have to listen to whether it be the person who has an addiction problem or the person who has a family member or friend that has an addiction problem. And they'd have to, in good faith, say this person wants this for the right reasons.
The bill also includes immunity clauses for both doctors and anyone who may administer the medication. But Garcia says there is very little data to suggest those clauses will even be needed.
Naloxone is a drug that is not known to have any side effects other than a person will wake up as though they've been taking drugs and have that hangover. But there's nothing that's been proved to be lethal about it.
Governor Tomlin signed the bill on March 9th. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Ashton Mara.
I'm Jessica Lilly. You're Inside Appalachia.
As access to addiction treatment in larger cities grows, rural communities are still struggling with a lack of resources. But in Bluefield, West Virginia, a much-anticipated alternative for recovery is just days away from opening. It's a non-medical treatment option, which means there is no Suboxone or methadone for addicts as they detox. There also aren't any doctors or medical professionals, but there is a staff of about 7 people. If there is a concern for seizures, like from alcohol, they send them to the hospital for a few days. This new long-term treatment facility will make 20 beds available to males who have had a run-in with the law. Some folks in Mercer County believe this non-medical, long-term treatment facility will be a game-changer for the region.
But I was dying to get out. I just didn't know how to get out.
Justin Clark spent most of the last 18 years of his life addicted to prescription pain pills.
I figured if the government lets go of pharmaceutical narcotics and a lot of people are on them, then they won't hurt me. In retrospect, it's kind of a justification I used to use.
After being arrested for the second time for driving under the influence of drugs, Clark decided he wanted to get clean, and the justice system helped him find a way. He qualified for and recently completed the recovery program at the Healing Place in Huntington. Now that program is serving as a model for a new facility in Bluefield, which Clark will be a part of. Clark is a replication team member at Four Seasons Recovery Center, a non-medical detox facility that's the first of its kind in southern West Virginia. Clark helps determine if applicants qualify for the program, and he also serves as a mentor to those receiving treatment. Workers are almost finished renovating what was once a school in Bluefield to make room for 20 men looking to recover from addiction.
This will be our detox dorm.
Terry Danielson is the program director.
So right now they're renovating the bathroom. This was a Head Start program before, so there was like kid toilets, you know.
Because Four Seasons Recovery Center is a non-medical detox facility, and Danielson explains that often, physical withdrawal from opiates starts with frequent bowel movements. So recovering addicts spend a lot of time in the bathroom. It's something Danielson battled through himself.
I couldn't sleep because I was going to try to kick heroin on my own and in detox on the couch, you know. And I couldn't. And
Danielson described experiencing cold sweats, using the bathroom frequently, but says the worst part was the mental obsession with finding another high to fight the sickness.
You're treading that fence at that point, so it's like, I know I shouldn't do anything wrong to get money to go score dope, but I can't feel like this, you know. Sports Center was on, cell phone sitting beside me. I'd pretty much robbed everybody that was in my phone as far as, you know, dope contacts. And I couldn't tell you what was on Sports Center. I was watching the TV and I couldn't tell you, you know, because my mind was somewhere else. And so, you know, I had already, you know, hit up a lot of, you know, I'd already exhausted, you know, family members helping financially, you know. So there was nobody to ask for any money.
Danielson's story doesn't begin with a troubled youth or exposure to drugs at a young age. He says he was one of the popular kids. He made good grades, played football, basketball, baseball, and even boxed. After high school, he was accepted at Notre Dame, University of North Carolina, and ended up at Marshall University. But no one's life is perfect, and Danielson struggled with regret.
I drank more, you know. And then it moved from that to ecstasy and cocaine.
Once Danielson realized he wasn't on his way to becoming a professional athlete, he lost even more motivation, delving deeper into addiction. Danielson yearned for structure and discipline, so he joined the Army, still repeating patterns of substance abuse until he eventually became addicted to pain pills. But when the scripts weren't easy to find on the streets, he found heroin. Danielson has been clean since November 2011 and says so far taking on this new leadership role as program director has been helpful in his own recovery.
I don't care to tell my story if that's what it takes to get somebody to relate, and I don't care to sacrifice personal time in order to help somebody else. And hopefully that's why they decided to hire me, you know, is the fact that maybe I've got something to offer.
As for Justin Clark, one of the peer mentors at the Bluefield facility who struggled with addiction to prescription narcotics, he says the non-medical treatment is working for him, where medicated treatment failed. Clark says he believes in this program because it's peer-driven and based on accountability and unity.
Being from here, it's real big for me because I grew up in this county. I know what's here. You know, you can't lie to me because I live here, you know. So for me to give back to my own community for so much I've took away for so many years is why I took this job, and to help others, because somebody carried a message to me and I'm going to carry a message to somebody else, and that's how this works.
Organizers expect a more concentrated impact around the facility itself. It's located on Preston Street in Bluefield, an area in town with a tarnished reputation. Director Terry Danielson.
Every location that I've witnessed one of these programs go into a tough part of the neighborhood has gotten better.
Community Connections Executive Director and Mercer County Commissioner Greg Puckett has traveled across the country researching prevention and recovery, and he too thinks the facility will help turn the neighborhood around.
You know, when you've got an area like this and you've got people that are willing to step up and clean their lives up, then we feel confident that the area around that will start to look at this as a positive and say, hey, I may want to get myself clean. I want to do more for my community. And I think that's the signal that we're giving out here. And, you know, it works much of the time. It's not a fail-safe. I mean, there are people that, of course, slide back into addiction. But we are excited about the potential and what it can mean here for us and the people that are going to be involved in the program.
Patients are referred to and qualify for the Four Seasons program after a run-in with the law. Four Seasons will be the first state-funded inpatient treatment facility in southern West Virginia that's available for free for addicts. Drug courts are becoming a more and more popular option for judges dealing with minor drug offenders in West Virginia. Instead of being incarcerated, offenders go through a highly structured, highly monitored rehabilitative process overseen by a probation officer and counselor. And as Roxy Todd reports, the program is doing more than saving the state money on prison costs. It's saving lives.
3 years ago, Michael Alloy became a circuit court judge in Marion County. In his first year on the bench, he became more and more troubled by the number of people he was sending to prison for drug crimes.
You know, I became a judge, to make matters better. And I couldn't feel good about looking from the bench at those in front of me and responding in such a way that I couldn't leave the bench and say, what have I done today that's made things better in their lives, made the community safer. What have I done?
Then he heard about drug courts. They've been in some West Virginia counties since 2006. Drug courts are an alternative sentencing program. Instead of sending an addict to prison, a judge can choose offenders to enroll in the program so they can receive addiction treatment.
If we treat the underlying addiction and people are in recovery, then they're far less likely to commit the same crime.
Drug court programs take a minimum of 1 year to complete, though most participants take at least a year and a half to finish. Participants undergo drug counseling, complete community service, take regular drug tests, and check in with a probation officer every day. Travis Zimmerman is a probation officer on Judge Alloy's drug court team. He used to work in prisons. He saw addicts get released and then come right back when they either couldn't or refused to get treatment.
So if you just want people to go to jail and you want to lock them up for 5 or 10 or 15 years and not do anything with them and not try to change the way they think or act or react, then don't expect them to come out any different than you put them in.
And what Zimmerman says is backed by figures. In West Virginia, about 1 in 4 of the inmates released from prison fall back into the habits that put them there in the first place. That's far below the national average of 43%, but that's still a lot of people being released and returning to crime. Zimmerman says most drug offenders aren't hardened criminals.
Granted, some of these folks, when they're addicted to opiates, do some pretty horrible things to people. You know, they do commit crimes. They do rob. They do burglarize. They do those things. But the reality of it is they do those things based on a need for their substance. They do those things because they're addicted to a substance. And for most of them, absent the addiction, they're pretty decent people.
Probation officers like Zimmerman, who work with the drug court program, spend a lot of their time helping recovering addicts find a safe place to live, food to eat, encouraging them to continue their education and find work.
You know, the last couple of days we've been talking about career and stuff like that. Do you have any prospects for a job?
Here's Officer Zimmerman talking with Mike, a participant in the drug court program.
Awesome. So he's going to put you on the books? Well, that's good.
Zimmerman is in charge of supervising 22 drug court participants, including 24-year-old Ashley, who was addicted to heroin.
It destroyed my life. I was put in jail also over heroin. I almost lost my children, which I have 3 children.
Ashley recently regained custody of her 3 children. She wants them to have the kind of childhood she never had.
My mom is also an addict, and my father, and they're also heroin users. My mother is on probation now, and my father, he's in prison. And my sister is a heroin addict also, and she's also in prison.
When she was arrested for heroin possession, Ashley went to a 28-day treatment program. When she was released, she moved back in with friends who were also drug addicts, so she turned back to her old habits. Then she failed a drug test and was sent back to prison. Judge Alloy wanted to send her to longer-term treatment, but she had to wait in prison for 5 months before Bette opened up. When she got out of treatment, Ashley decided that if she was really going to stay off drugs, then she had to leave her old friends and move to a new town.
It's probably one of the hardest decisions I've ever made, because all my family also is back in Clarksburg. But I come from a line of addicts, so, you know, it is hard. It's definitely hard. I get homesick still sometimes.
Judge Alloy says a lot of the people that come through drug court don't have families who can afford rehab.
And I can't feel good as a court that we will treat people who are poor, disenfranchised, do not have certain services available to them, different than others of a higher socioeconomic group. I think that's wrong.
But treating and supervising addicts can be costly. William Elenfeld is a U.S. attorney for the Northern District of West Virginia. He says drug courts can be very resource intensive for any county, especially in remote areas.
It's not as easy as saying we want to do it. We have to make sure the probation office has the people that can supervise the participants in the program. They need to engage and talk to them every day. They need to call them in the evening to make sure that they're not depressed or that they're not high.
Now there are 21 adult drug courts in 38 counties, with three more in development. A law passed by the West Virginia legislature in 2013 requires every judicial circuit in West Virginia offer an adult drug court by July of next year. The law is known as the Justice Reinvestment Act. It's aimed at taking on the state's prison overcrowding problems by lowering the mandatory sentences for minor drug crimes and focusing resources on community-based treatment options. Elenfeld says, in the long run, these drug courts are worth the cost.
Because the cost of incarceration are much greater for a lot of reasons, not just the dollars, but also the cost on society of incarcerating so many people. If we can keep people out of prison, get them clean, get them back in the workforce, then we're going to get through this storm that we're in much quicker.
According to the National Association of Drug Court Professionals, one in four offenders who go through a drug court program return to prison. Here in West Virginia, some drug courts are even more successful. Jennifer Bailey is the judge in Kanawha County's program.
When you see the people graduate, you see what they're doing now, it makes you want to keep going and doing it.
And Ashley was successful. She got her children back, and now she's engaged to be married.
They tell you, wait for the miracle, you know, and it says, wait for the miracle will happen. But then you come to realize, like, you are the miracle. You know, like, look what you just went through, and you're alive. So there is a purpose for you here on this earth if you've made it. So, I mean, people just need to step back and look at it. Look how grateful they are for the things they do have still. And that it's not too late.
Ashley recently celebrated her first full year of being clean since she was 14 years old. She and her fiancé have a new baby girl on the way. The baby is due just before Ashley graduates from the drug court program. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Roxy Todd.
In the interest of disclosure, Judge Alloy, who is featured in this story, is a close personal friend of Roxy Todd. You can read more about the story and see maps and data about heroin in West Virginia at wvpublic.org/heroin. To end our show, we hear from Rance Garrison and learn about his strong connection to Appalachia. He grew up in Lee County, Virginia, and is currently in AmeriCorps Vista at WMMT in Whitesburg, Kentucky. He sent us this memory about his family's home place and why he feels strongly about growing roots and staying in Appalachia.
Gravy and biscuits and the Garden of Eden. When I was a little boy, after church, my mother and I would visit the farm where she had spent her entire childhood to visit her family. That farm is an 88-acre tract of land that lies on the mountain between Woodway and Stickleyville down in Lee County, Virginia. My mother lives there now, much as my grandmother did when I was a boy. To this day, whenever I visit it, I am filled with an intense array of emotions, most notably longing. This place, with its muddy creeks rushing down the mountain and its barnyard smell of cow manure, and its lush trees which canopy the whole area around the house, is not only a part of my identity as an Appalachian, it's a part of the daily context in which I live my life as a human being, as a person. When I think of the home I want to return to, I think of my mother and I think of this beautiful stretch of land. When my parents divorced, my mother and I moved on to the farm. I would spend my weekend with my father and my father's relatives, but throughout the week, the farm was my home. My uncles, who had never left there, were farmers. Tobacco, cattle, corn, apples, cherries, mostly tobacco, and cattle. The old farmhouse was heated by a wood-burning stove in the basement. Family photographs covered so much of the walls that you couldn't see the bare plywood underneath. Most of the photos were black and white or had once been in color, but had aged into that sepia technicolor hue that we associate with the 1970s. The parts of the walls that weren't lined with photographs were lined with bookshelves and books. Now, some people might suspect that a pair of bearded mountain farmers would be unread men, and they would be quite wrong, blinded by stereotypes and prejudice. My grandmother, who wasn't afraid to use a curse word or four when the occasion called for it, which was apparently often, would sit in her rocking chair and listen to the sounds of bluegrass gospel. The Christian Airs and the Good Shepherd Quartet are two of the ones that spring immediately to mind. My grandmother refused to cook on anything but a wood-burning stove, and so there was a second one in the kitchen, one for heat, one for meat. My mother and her sisters had offered to buy her an electric stove, but she had always refused, and so every morning at 5 a.m., I would be brought from sleep, still groggy, by the sound of the morning fire being lit. Keep in mind that I'm only 28 as of this writing. It sounds very well as if I'm speaking of a time long ago, but in truth, this was the mid-1990s, the age of the dawn of the Internet, which, of course, we didn't have. In fact, we didn't have cable either. We could pick up two stations on the television in the living room, which was the only one in the house. Channel 11 out of Johnson City, Channel 5, though I'm not sure where it was out of, and a PBS station that you had to click the dial to the UHF setting to get to. Soon after the fire was lit, I would begin to hear the crackle of bacon, its smell drifting into the bedroom where I slept. The air would still be cold on the winter mornings, and blankets would nestle me like a loving embrace. My grandmother cooked gravy and biscuits every morning on a wood-burning stove, and that's what I woke up to most days. Slowly, I would come around and wake up. I would get out of bed and feel the cool linoleum floor beneath my feet. I would get ready for school and eat gravy and biscuits and rush off to the bus stop way down at the end of the driveway. I didn't know it then, but that was a sort of paradise in and of itself, living in the slow-paced way of life of my childhood. These days, my first instinct in the morning is to check my emails, then drink some coffee, then check my Facebook, then make sure that I haven't neglected to reply to anybody. The great irony, of course, of humanity's technological advancements is that even as we have grown more digitally connected, this digital connectedness has in many ways isolated us from some of life's simpler pleasures and from parts of ourselves. The smell of bacon cooking slowly on a wood-burning stove, the unhurried rising of the sun through the homemade curtains, accompanied by the rooster's crow out in the barnyard. These are the sorts of things that were a part of my daily existence in childhood, and I confess that I often wish they were a part of my existence now. I'm sure I'm not the only one, young, old, or in between, raised in the hills of Appalachia who feels the same way. It seems at times as though the world has moved on, but in our hearts, we have not. There are still some of us who remember what the Garden of Eden was like.
We had help producing Inside Appalachia this week from WUNC in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, WUKY in Lexington, Kentucky, and WITF in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. Music in today's show was provided by Jake Sheps and Matt Jackford. I'm Jessica Lilly. Inside Appalachia is a news and public affairs production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education and more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.